Welcome to this Forthright Radio for January 6th, 2021. I'm Joy LeClaire. We have a very full show for you today, our first in this new year. With us for the hour is Richard Kreitner. We'll be speaking with him about his book, Break It Up, Secession, Division, and the Secret History of America's Imperfect Union, as well as how that history illuminates our current situation. But before I introduce Richard Kreitner, a moment to honor the passing of Carrie Dann, Indigenous leader, land rights activist, and water protector, who died at the age of 88. Beginning in the 1970s, Carrie Dann and her sister Mary refused to pay grazing fees to the federal government over its repeated violations of the 1863 Treaty of Ruby Valley, which defined Western Shoshone Territory. In the 1990s, armed federal marshals rounded up the Dann sisters' horses and cattle in a series of sometimes violent raids, setting up a legal fight that went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court and the United Nations. Rather different treatment than the Bundy family experienced, with far less claim to violate federal grazing laws. You can go to democracynow.org to view or listen to their interview with Carrie Dann. Carrie Dann, presente. Now, on to our show. Richard Kreitner has been an editor and writer at The Nation magazine since 2012. His essays and articles have appeared in the New York Times, the Boston Globe, the Washington Post, USA Today, Slate, and the Baffler, among other places. His latest book is Break It Up, Secession, Division, and the Secret History of America's Imperfect Union, published by Little Brown and Company. His earlier book is Booked, A Traveler's Guide to Literary Locations Around the World. With that, we welcome you to Forthright Radio, Richard Kreitner.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Well, Richard, when our show ends, which is 1 p.m. Eastern Time, proceedings are scheduled to begin in the joint session of Congress to receive the certified Electoral College vote of the 50 states, presided over by outgoing Vice President Pence. The runoff Senate election in Georgia appears to have resulted in both seats being won by the Democratic candidates, Raphael Warnock by a secure margin of more than 53,000 votes, and John Ossoff by a far narrower margin of just over 17,000, with about 2% of ballots uncounted, largely from precincts in which the Democrats are expected to win. This is considerably larger than the margin with which Biden is certified to have won the presidential race in Georgia. Neither of the Republican incumbents have conceded the race, and it's highly likely that the results will be contested with an unknowable amount of time before the results are certified. Meanwhile, yesterday, the Pennsylvania Senate's swearing-in ceremony devolved into a chaotic scene when state GOP senators refused to seat a Democratic member who had won re-election and whose election had been certified. They seized control of the proceedings from the Democratic lieutenant governor after his objections. And as we broadcast, pro-Trump demonstrators are rallying in front of the White House, where Trump is scheduled to speak to them at any minute. For many, this seems a time fraught with danger and chaos, and many ask, can the Union hold together? Well, your study of the history of the United States of America informs your analysis. Please share with our listeners your thoughts on this historic moment now, and then we will explore the history itself.
Great. Yeah, thank you again for having me. I mean, a lot to chew on there. Many of what you talked about seems almost as if ripped from the pages of my book, especially chapters about much earlier periods in American history where constitutional norms and practices and institutions were much more up for grabs than they have been for the last 50, 100, even 150 years. To just take one example, what happened in Pennsylvania of the Republicans refusing to seat a duly elected Democratic representative is very similar to the fights that unfolded in Congress Washington and elsewhere around the country in state legislatures in the years after the Civil War during Reconstruction, when Congress, at least Republicans who had been loyal to the Union, refused to accept Southern members who had been elected to Congress because they disagreed as to whether the Southern states were back in the Union after having lost the Civil War, or whether they needed to go through some kind of larger Reconstruction process in order for that to happen. That is an echo that kind of springs out to me immediately. The Pence situation in Congress today, of what he will do and how far Republicans will go to try to thwart the certification of Joe Biden's Electoral College victory, reminds me of some stories that I tell in the book about contested elections in the 19th century after the 1800 election, and I think even more notably a historical parallel, the 1876 presidential election, both of which were conflicted and contested for months after the election day and before inauguration day. Nobody really knew who would be president or whether the country would kind of fall into some kind of massive political violence or civil war. We can go further into those examples. But what this says to me, it kind of affirms my hunch a few years ago when I started this project, which is that the future seems to be far more radically open for this country in terms of, in both good and bad ways, than it has been for really quite a while. And I think, as we saw last month, the word secession kind of sprung back into American politics when the chair of the Republican Party, Alan West, threatened that Republican-leaning states should either form a separate union within the United States to protest Biden's inauguration and presidency, or perhaps even secede from the union itself. These words like secession and disunion that have been absent for really quite a long time have kind of returned to American life, and I think it spells a very tumultuous and troublesome decade ahead.
Yeah, it was pretty good timing on your part to do the 5 years of research that resulted in this book. And lest our listeners think, oh, history, I can't stand history, it's so boring, yada, 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 I just want to remind you that the past isn't dead. It isn't even past.
Right.
Headline from yesterday: last known widow of Civil War veteran dies at 101. Helen, wow. Viola Jackson, the last known widow of a Civil War soldier, has died at 101. She died on December 16th, 2020. In 1936, when Jackson was 17 years old, she married James Bolin, a 93-year-old widower who served in the 14th Missouri Cavalry during the Civil War. The war ended in 1865, 156 years ago. So we are far more closely connected to things that seem as far away as the Civil War than we usually think about. Richard, any comments about that before we go on?
Well, I'm trying to recover from the idea of a 17-year-old marrying a 92 or 93-year-old, whatever you said. But setting aside that deep personal disgust, yes, that's absolutely right. You know, it's still a very young country. I don't know how many generations back to the Revolution, but it's certainly less than 10. And didn't we hear recently that John Tyler's grandson is still alive or something like that? It's really not very long ago. I mean, as for the Faulkner quote, I think there are two reasons why people should be reading American history right now, and you know, ideally my book, but there's a lot of really great work being done in both these respects. One is, as the Faulkner quote suggests, the past is not even dead. It's not even past. What happened in the past shapes what is going on right now in all kinds of ways, in our institutions, in our political parties, in our practices, in our attitudes towards divisive questions of race and class. So the past shapes the present. And then secondly, there are important historical parallels. Nothing is ever exact. You know, there's another famous expression, I'm pretty sure it was Mark Twain, that the past never repeats itself, it only rhymes with the present. And there are many important rhymes between past episodes in American history, such as the ones that I discussed, and especially, as you note, around the Civil War era and what's going on today. And when you read about what happened then and how it turned out and what people needed to do in order to achieve a peaceful and hopefully a just outcome, or things that they did not do that led to very negative outcomes for a lot of people, can be instructive today as to how we should behave, both politically and I think also socially with our friends and family, and how we treat people of different political persuasions. So I think this is an excellent time to be studying American history. For myself, I had this hunch that the story of disunion was relevant today. It was kind of in the late Obama period. It wasn't so much a response to Trump as it was to some things I saw going on in the late Obama presidency. But working on the book, throughout the Trump presidency offered, I think, something of a refuge from this present-day turmoil and a certain consoling perspective on what was going on today in the past. And just one more thing, you know, a lot of people say that we've been through worse before as a country and we prevailed, so surely we will survive this too. But my studies of the past show that there was really no guarantee that we were going to survive either the Civil War as one country intact or other much less well-known episodes in American history of conflict and contestation and possibly even actual physical division. And it took human effort to ensure that that happened. And in some cases, it was due to compromises that really sold out large groups of the population, especially African Americans. So, you know, we shouldn't be complacent today that we will survive, or necessarily, I think, this is probably the most controversial aspect of the book, necessarily that we should, depending on what that costs. So while I don't want to suggest that the past should necessarily be a consolation for us in the present because we survived then and we will now, what I find consoling is that it was up to Americans then to decide their own fate. That is the nature and the purpose of self-government. And it's similar today. It's up to us, I think, to decide what kind of country we want to be, and indeed whether we want to be one country.
Well, Richard Kreitner, among the other things your book, Break It Up, Secession, Division, and the Secret History of America's Imperfect Union does is offer a reality check on the mythologies that have arisen over the years of our history, among them the disposition of the colonies leading to the American Revolution and the establishment of the United States. They saw themselves as sovereign nations in their own right, and it was a big deal to give up that sovereignty to form what they called at the time a confederacy after the Revolutionary War, correct?
That's right. Yeah, I mean, they didn't see themselves as sovereign nations as in sovereign from England, but from each other. They had really no connection to one another. There was really no trade between the colonies. There was no really intercourse of any kind. And they had different ethnic backgrounds. Often, you know, many people were French or German. Others were, of course, you know, mostly British or Scottish or Irish. And they had different religious persuasions. But they had a much closer connection to the mother country, to England, than they did to one another. And it was that kind of independence from each other that they really tried to preserve as long as they possibly could. Most stories about American history kind of skip over the colonial period rather quickly, especially stories about the coming to be of the American nation. But when you think about it, it was a century and a half between the settlement of Jamestown and Plymouth, Massachusetts, the earliest lasting American settlements, North American settlements, and the formation of the Union in the Revolution, which is the same period of time, a century and a half, since the Civil War. It was a really long period of time. And the reason why they didn't join together was not because nobody thought of the idea of federation. There were plans of union proposed by William Penn, the founder of Pennsylvania, and by Benjamin Franklin. But they were rejected out of hand because, again, the colonies really wanted nothing to do with one another. And when they joined together in the Revolution, it was really a means to an end. It wasn't an end in itself. They still wanted nothing to do with one another. They simply realized that the only way that they could secure their independence from England was to fight together and then to form one kind of almost like an international alliance, if you will. And right after the Revolution, it almost immediately breaks apart because nobody really wanted to have anything to do with one another in the first place. So it took a very long time before this idea of a truly united country achieved purchase in people's hearts and minds.
You shed light on some attitudes. Even at that time, the colonies seemed to segment themselves in identities as Northerners and Southerners. And you quote different letters from people like George Washington, and I forget who the New Englander was, but each of them criticize the inhabitants of the other region using the same terms. They're dirty and stupid. I thought that was very interesting, just in terms of our modern understanding of projection.
That's a very good observation. That's definitely one thing that I'm not sure consciously or not that I wanted to point out, which is that these differences, these really bitter enmities between Americans of different regions and also different political parties, but at the time the parties were really segmented regionally, began far earlier than we tend to think. It's not really a product of the Civil War era or really about slavery necessarily. It was kind of there from the beginning. Before the Revolution, I think you're referring to George Washington, his observations in the Continental Army encampment outside Boston as early as 1775. And that was really the first time that Americans from different colonies, soon to be states, had anything to do with one another. Because as I said, there was very little travel or communication between them. It was the first time they really encountered one another in close quarters, and they absolutely despised each other. Because again, they had very different backgrounds and different cultural identities. So they totally loathed each other. And it was one example, and this happens a lot in American history, where closer contact breeds more disagreement than anything else. And as I say, it took really quite a long time for them to overcome that, and I kind of argue that they never really did. But these regional antipathies predate the establishment of the United States and last until the present day.
I don't know if I could say that I derive comfort from the knowledge that loathing existed even during the Revolutionary War time when we were supposedly united, etc. But it does take some of the feeling of shock that I have experienced over the last, 20, 30 years with increasing recognition of the polarization in our country. I had been raised to believe that we are these United States and we have more in common than we have not in common. And it has been an experience of shock for me to be forced to see how ugly and loathing is actually a usable word in the context. And we are seeing that play out literally as you and I are speaking, Richard, in the question of will we have a peaceful transition of power from one president to another? So anyway, I thank you for that. It's a reality check. But let's get back to the mythology and let's start with, if you want to briefly talk about the period right after the Revolutionary War, where there was the Articles of Confederation, which didn't work and led to, we've got to do a constitution. Don't spend a lot of time on the Article of Confederation, but do give a little context.
I will. Yeah, I just want to go back just real quick, because you mentioned that this belief that we are these United States. And I think it's very interesting that we often kind of invoke the name of the country as itself an argument about that country. And that's really how it began. It's a very weird name for a country to have. It's not France or China or Russia. It's the United States of America. It's a claim. And when you look at how it got that name, it's very clear that it's kind of an ambitious name. It's an aspirational name. They weren't observing that the states were united at that time, because they weren't. They were hoping that in time they would become united. But the name implies the possibility of its opposite, the possibility that that which is united can come to be divided or disunited. So the name itself, to me, suggests not so much what it purports to, which is union, but the ever-present possibility of its undoing, of disunion. So just a little riff on that. The 1780s, I think, is one of the most interesting periods of American history because, as I said, they never really wanted to form a union. It wasn't the goal. It was kind of an accidental byproduct of the Revolution. So afterwards, they kind of look around and they say, well, do we really want this country to work out? What would it take? And the Articles of Confederation was a very weak constitution. A lot of people liked it that way because, as we were talking about with the colonial period, they were jealous of their local prerogatives, kind of autonomy, and they didn't really want to give it up in order to form a stronger nation. Some people did want to do that, George Washington, Alexander Hamilton, and that was largely because they thought that a stronger nation, a more integrated kind of continental economy would benefit them, to be frank about it, would benefit really the 1% of that day and enable them, you know, their profits to grow. It was really a commercial enterprise more than a political one, the idea of forming a so-called more perfect union. So they take advantage of these crises that break out in the 1780s, especially the year 1786. There's a populist rebellion in Massachusetts, Shays Rebellion, of former revolutionary veterans who are irate because of high debts and high taxes, and they feel like they're being pinched for the benefit of the wealthy few. So that's one crisis that the nationalists, as historians call them, took advantage of in order to introduce a new constitution. Then there were bitter divisions between North and South and East and West over such things as whether to press Spain, which controlled New Orleans at the time, and therefore the Mississippi River, to open up the Mississippi River to American traffic. It's a whole thorny, complicated issue, but trade disputes was a major cause of tension between the states and between the regions. But what happened ultimately is that they overthrew the Constitution as it then existed, the Articles of Confederation, and took it on themselves, these, you know, roughly 40 or 50 men in Philadelphia, to introduce a new one. Now, that's essentially, I think, a coup d'etat, because it was extra-constitutional. The Articles of Confederation required unanimous support from the states for any amendment, and certainly for, you know, throwing it out and writing an entirely new constitution. But when they introduced the new one in Philadelphia and put it to the country for a vote, it required only support from 9 states rather than all 13. And some of the states, Rhode Island, North Carolina, they held out for quite a few years and argued that it was the nationalists, the people like Washington and Hamilton, who had dissolved the union that then existed and created a new one. And I think, you know, we obviously have these mythologies, as you say, about the American founding and especially about the American Constitution. But if it were to happen today, I think we would all be extremely alarmed and probably call it a coup d'etat. So that's kind of my take on the 1780s. It's kind of a radical one. But yes, does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. And you have a quote in your book. I'm not sure to whom it's attributed, but after Shay's Rebellion, when the elites recognized they had to do something, I'm quoting your book now, they saw the violence as heralding something, quote, rather worse than anarchy, a pure democracy, end of
right.
quote. And in the process of deciding what to do about that, they very explicitly recognized that it would be far easier to undermine pure democracy in a larger geographic area than a smaller one. And you also kind of burst some of the recent bubbles of admiration around Alexander Hamilton. Would you share some of those burst bubbles and also the concept that the larger the geographic area, the less likely pure democracy can be part of the system?
Sure, yeah. I mean, this was really the kind of crucial insight that sent me down the road of this entire project, which was the realization that as it was designed, and I think in certain respects as it still serves, the Constitution and a large union, a large consolidated nation, really serves the purposes of the defenders of the status quo, especially an egalitarian status quo, rather than those who are trying to redistribute property and power more equally. And this was Madison's crucial insight that led to the Constitution. Because in the 1780s, there was this horrible economic depression that a lot of historians say was pretty much on par with that of the 1930s. And as I say, in Massachusetts, there were these populists who were insisting on their state legislatures passing laws that would alleviate their debt and tax burdens. And they actually took over Rhode Island, is kind of the crucial state here, where this populist coalition came in and they passed paper money laws, which allowed debtors to much more easily pay off their debts. And this was horribly unpopular with the creditors, with the wealthy of that time. And Madison realized that if you made the government across the entire continent, you know, so the Constitution bans paper money as kind of the first order of business when they get to Philadelphia, because they all agree that we can't have these wealth-distributing measures passing at the national level. So if you make a coalition like in Rhode Island or the rebellion in Massachusetts succeed at a national level because of the transportation technologies of the day, the really slow communication, you're never going to get everybody from New Hampshire down to Georgia to join together in any kind of protest movement or any kind of progressive or populist movement. So that's kind of why Madison believed that he called it extend the sphere of national politics, you make it less likely that there will be what he called communication and concert among any particular class of people. So this is well known. This is in Federalist Number 10 and kind of the crucial essay explaining Madison's thought. But what a lot of people skip over is that in that essay, he's very specific about who he is trying to disempower by extending the sphere of American politics. It's not any particular class of Americans. It's specifically those who are in favor of, as he says, an abolition of debts or an equal distribution of property. So when I read that, you know, my eyes kind of jumped out of my face because this was 2014, 3 years after Occupy Wall Street, in the middle of the first Black Lives Matter movement. And it seemed like it was incredibly easy for these protest movements to dissipate and not really accomplish their goal in this large national system. And it seemed to me like Madison was explicitly saying that that was really the purpose of setting up the Constitution in the first place. And so that's kind of, it explains my thinking on that. As for Alexander Hamilton, yeah, I definitely am trying to burst his recent popularity, and that's for a number of reasons. One, he was really against democracy, as that quote. I don't think that's Hamilton himself, but he would have totally agreed with it. He was really against democracy, and not just direct democracy, but really representative democracy as well. He wanted to concentrate power in as few hands as possible, and he wanted to really return the United States to a much more British-style form of government. He wanted senators to have lifetime terms, and the president as well. So I definitely think that those of us who have seen the musical and been kind of taken in by the renewed Hamilton cult should think again. There's one letter that kind of combines these two themes of what I'm talking about with the reactionary kind of regressive nature of a large union and Hamilton's anti-democratic sentiments. And this is really the last letter that he writes in 1804, right before he was rowed across the Hudson River for his duel with Aaron Burr. There's a secessionist movement going on in New England at the time, and I show in the book that that's really what led to the Hamilton-Burr duel in the first place. Not that they simply disliked each other, which is kind of what the musical suggests, but that they disagreed with whether this separatist movement in New England should be countenanced or supported. Burr was kind of flirting with it, and Hamilton was really resolutely opposed to it. But why was he opposed to it? This is kind of what I'm getting at. It's not simply that he loved America and wanted the nation to continue. He writes to a colleague in New England that to break up the Union would be unfortunate, that it shouldn't be done, because it would make the real disease in American politics worse. And that disease, he says, is democracy, which, if you broke down the Union, would become more virulent in each of the parts. That's what he's saying. So he agrees with Madison, and he's saying that we should keep the Union together, because if we break it up, democracy will take off in each of the separate parts, because people will find it easier to influence government the closer it is to their lives and to their homes. So I'm not totally sure, even for myself, whether these arguments translate directly to today, because things have changed, obviously. The 14th Amendment changed things. The Civil Rights Bill of 1964 changed things. But I think it's worth thinking about whether the Union, the Constitution, is synonymous with democracy. A lot of, you know, critics of Trump on the left kind of tend to suggest that they are, and I'm not really so sure that they are. Just one more kind of example. The Senate, which, of course, we're all talking about. I'm personally relieved that the Democrats seem to have taken both seats and will have the barest razor-thin majority in the Senate. But when you think about it, the two senators from Georgia represent about 10 million people, 10 million people in the state of Georgia, whereas the two senators from California represent 40 million people, four times as much. And, of course, the smallest state, Wyoming, has one-tenth the population of Georgia. And I saw a statistic that if there are 50 senators each from the Democratic and Republican parties, that the 50 Democratic senators represent 40 million more people than the Republican senators. So that's really 40 million disenfranchised American voters. And that's the system designed by the founders and really having the effect that it did then, which is putting a really cold, wet blanket on any movement for real reform.
We're speaking with Richard Kreitner about his book, Break It Up, Secession, Division, and the Secret History of America's Imperfect Union. There's so much more in your book that's really fascinating that we won't be able to even begin to talk about, but it's important that we do discuss sort of what you were just getting at, and that's the original sin of the Constitution, which is around representation and involving slavery, and it required the compromising of morality for the creation and maintenance of the Union. Now, among the things I found surprising and I learned from your book is that some Southern states kind of used their refusal to ratify the Constitution kind of as extortion. Mm-hmm. The 3/5 clause and all that kind of stuff. I'm fairly sure our listeners are familiar with that. What I did not understand was, after the Constitution was ratified by the 9 states, the history up until the Civil War, where it was the North that was mulling over the idea of secession. Would you share with our listeners that history?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, this is one of the, you know, my really surprising discoveries. I went into the project with the hunch that it can't only have been the Southerners, the future Confederates, who considered secession from the Union. It was probably other people who had the idea at other times. And that's indeed true. You know, there's two kind of major Northern movements or moments where Northerners are considering disunion. The first, I mentioned before, is the early 19th century, from about 1800 to about 1815. And the Hamilton Bird Duels is part of that. And this was a New England response to the presidencies of Thomas Jefferson and James Madison, these Virginians, Republicans, whereas most New Englanders were Federalists, and especially to the Louisiana Purchase of 1803, which most Americans think of, and I think most of us are taught in school, was this great moment of nation building, where Jefferson, for a mere pittance, $15 million, was able to double the size of the United States. And who could be against that? Well, the entire region of New England was fiercely against it because they realized that slavery would probably extend into most of that territory and that they would lose power in the Congress and in national politics. And they thought that the country was big enough. And so they opposed the Louisiana Purchase and especially the creation of new slave states out of it. And they threatened secession unless slavery was either abolished in that area or the Three-Fifths Clause, which they now regretted agreeing to that compromise, was repealed. And then, especially, they were against the War of 1812, which they saw no purpose in fighting. New England had still pretty close ties with Old England, with Great Britain, and they didn't want to fight the war, and they really tried to sit it out. And there's this really dramatic moment at the end of 1814, going into 1815, when New Englanders gather in a convention in Hartford, Connecticut, and it's widely believed in the country, and certainly in New England, where they wanted this to happen, that the delegates would announce New England's secession from the Union. Instead, they sent a list of demands to Washington, to President James Madison, insisting that he end the war, that he repeal the Three-Fifths Compromise, that presidents not be allowed to come from the same state, one after the other, targeting this Virginia dynasty. And it's very likely that if they didn't get their way, which they weren't going to get their way, that they would have seceded at another convention that they had scheduled for a few months later in Boston. But in the meantime, just as their delegates are getting, these emissaries are getting to Washington with this list of demands, comes word that the war is over, a peace treaty has been ratified in Europe, and they look like not only fools, but traitors. And they're laughed out of town, and that's really the end of the Federalist Party. So that's one kind of dramatic moment where New Englanders threaten secession. Then the other one, these are really the heroes of the book in my thinking, are the radical abolitionists of the 1830s through the 1850s who supported Northern secession from the Union to protest, and they believed actually practically undermine the institution of slavery. They really regretted these compromises in the Constitution, not only the Three-Fifths Clause, but the Fugitive Slave Clause, which required Northern states to participate in the recapture and return of runaways from bondage, and another clause where they required the federal government to help put down insurrections in the states, which was a provision responding not only to Shays' Rebellion, but to the fear of slave rebellions. And these abolitionists believe that those guarantees effectively underwrote the price of slaves, because without them, the institution of human slavery would be much less secure, and therefore the prices would plummet, because people wouldn't want to invest in such insecure property. So they believed that the North seceding from the Union would create an international border at the Mason-Dixon line and the Ohio River, which would draw fugitives away from slavery and ultimately undermine and end the institution. A lot of even anti-slavery people in their own time and historians since have doubted whether it would have worked that way. Some people accuse them of leaving the slaves in their misery because these Northerners cared more about their own clean consciences than they did about ending slavery. I think that's kind of an unfair critique because they did have this practical vision for how it would end slavery. But either way, I just think that there's something so bold and courageous about these abolitionists who really thought that the Union, as at the beginning, should be a means to an end, and that end being life and liberty and the pursuit of happiness rather than an end in itself, and that the country should only survive if it was going to be devoted to those kinds of ideals and protections for people's rights. And I think that we could really use a little hint of that today. We're about to inaugurate this president who's really staked his coming presidency and really his entire political career on the idea and the possibility of compromise. But I think what we learn from American history, from the Southern extortionist threats that you mentioned, and also more recently from Barack Obama's presidency, is that by saying that you're going to compromise no matter what, you're really giving up ground. You're negotiating from a position of weakness, and you're letting the other side know that they can threaten to walk away or to pull the trigger on secession or violence or some other kind of extreme remedy at any time, and merely by threatening to do that, they can get their way without even actually having to go through with it. So that's kind of a long way from your question about the Northerners, but I'm hoping that readers, at least those on the left, and I think anybody would enjoy the book, but that's my political affinity, I think she'd look to these radical abolitionists for a taste of the kind of gumption that I think is really required at this moment, where they were calling Southerners on their bluff and saying, oh, you want to secede? Okay, go ahead. We'll see how well that serves you. And I think that we can use a little bit of that today.
Short of secession, there were different movements of nullification. And I think that's a topic that is particularly relevant these days because of movements to nullify different groups that claim a constitutional authority to defy or ignore laws, in sense nullifying them. Talk about how this played out in the situations you were already discussing.
Sure, yeah. I mean, that's another word that's kind of sprung back to American politics in a way that I think would have really surprised people 10, 15 years ago. You heard a lot about this with regards to Obamacare, people talking about nullifying Obamacare. And I think we're going to hear more about that in the next couple of years, depending on what legislation the Biden administration and the Democratic Congress is able to pass. There are kind of two episodes in American history that really stand out to me. Well, a few, but I'll talk about two. One is the famous nullification crisis in South Carolina in 1833. Where the Southerners objected to a tariff that had been passed. And the South Carolinians especially relied on their exports of cotton and of other slave-picked goods for their economy. So they thought that these tariffs hurt them more than anybody else, and they decided that they weren't going to pay them. They were going to violate federal law, and they dared the federal government to intervene and force them to give in and then to obey the law. I think that it was really about slavery, as most things in Southern politics, of course, were, and that they were kind of, it was a trial run in case Congress should someday pass legislation either banning or limiting slavery. They wanted a trial run to be able to say, we can go ahead and ignore federal law as we want to. And there was this epic clash with Andrew Jackson, who was the president at the time, who had been born in the South and sympathized with the anti-tariff position, but also cared a lot about national unity and national power. And there was this showdown where they kind of stared each other down. Ultimately, as with everything else in American history between the Revolution and the Civil War, and really since the Civil War as well, the country survived and Civil War was averted because of compromise. Jackson agreed to lower the tariffs, and the Southerners agreed that they would withdraw their nullification resolution. But what people kind of overlook in that episode, and which I think is important today and connects to what I was just talking about earlier, is that it worked. The threat of nullification actually did work to get the South Carolinians what they wanted, which was the tariffs to be repealed. What that taught them was that simply the threat of doing this kind of extreme action was enough to get them what they want. And I think there's a pretty strong case to be made that that's what convinced them in 1860, 1861, that threatening to secede from the Union or doing it would convince Lincoln and the Republicans to buckle and give in and give the South what they wanted, which was the repeal of the Republican platform, which banned slavery from the territories. And it's Lincoln's incredible heroism that he kind of called them on that bluff and made them go through with their threats. It cost a lot of lives and money, but of course he won. And then the other, you know, a lot of people don't realize, as I was saying, that these anti-slavery Northerners embraced disunion. They also embraced nullification in the 1850s when they were opposing the Fugitive Slave Act, which strengthened the mechanisms by which the Fugitive Slave Clause of the Constitution was enforced and really made it every American citizen's responsibility to participate in the roundup of fugitives if they were called upon to do so by the authorities. And several states passed laws effectively nullifying that statute. Ralph Waldo Emerson, famous Massachusetts philosopher, said that the Union itself is dissolved the moment the wicked law is enacted. Again, I think there's something in that we can learn from. And then also the Dred Scott case a few years later in 1857 was this horrific Supreme Court case which said that black people, even if they were free, could never be citizens of the United States, and that slavery could not be banned from the Western territories, an attempt to outlaw that Republican platform. A lot of state legislatures in the North passed resolutions saying that this does not apply to us, this is not actual law, this is totally made up. So again, I think there's something to be learned from that, but it also points to, as today, where secession is being talked about on both sides of the spectrum, nullification I mentioned, has been championed in recent years by the right, but also by the left. You know, that's why marijuana is legal in 12 or 13 states, because people decided to just completely ignore the federal law or dare the federal government to enforce it, which it has not proven willing to do. So in all of these periods, including the present, I think there's this kind of weakening of norms and of assumptions about what is possible in the constitutional structure of the United States. And that often leads to messy circumstances, like the Civil War, to say the least, but also to progress, because there's something good, I think, about challenging these hidebound assumptions and mothballed institutions that haven't really been tested or brought up to the present.
There's so many parallels. Tariffs, of course, is a big deal under the Trump administration. Didn't hear about them for quite a while until he came up with them again. Another parallel, I noted Lincoln was elected with about 40% of the vote. We don't really remember how chaotic his election was, but a parallel with our current situation. Among his most fervent supporters were a group of young men called the Wide Awakes. And it resonated with the current calling of woke attitudes around race in particular.
I'm glad you got that.
We don't really have time to go into the Wide Awakes, but
you caught the Wide Awakes, though. That was kind of a subtle little morsel that I left there for particularly attentive readers, the connection with woke today.
Yeah, well, like I said, we don't really have time to go into that, but listeners can look that up for themselves. It's a pretty interesting story. When South Carolina and others seceded from the United States, as you had earlier mentioned, they invoked the invalidity of the Constitution of the United States for the very reason you said, that instead of being ratified with 100% of the colonies, as was required by what was then the law of the land, the Articles of Confederation. So they said they were within their rights not to be bound by the Constitution. Now, we go back and forth about whether there is a right to secede or not. There's no real answer to that, but I'd love for you to explore that question.
I think a kind of controversial or heterodox view of this. I think what's clear is that at the time that the states did ratify the Constitution, everybody assumed that they had the right to secede, that they had the right to leave the Union, to annul their agreement to the Constitution by the same mechanism with which they granted it, which is a popularly elected convention convened for that purpose. I think it's very clear that they all assume that to be the case, and three states, New York, Rhode Island, and maybe Virginia, I kind of forget, all explicitly said that. So if you take an originalist view of the Constitution, which I don't necessarily do, it seems pretty clear to me that that assumption prevailed at the time. Is it possible, as Jackson argued, as Lincoln argued, that that changed over time, that what had been a means to an end, the Union, in the end, over time became an end in itself? And an unbreakable union? I suppose that's, as you say, pretty undetermined, inconclusive, philosophical, up for debate. And that's what the Civil War was ultimately fought over. But that was certainly the claim of the South Carolinians. And one other parallel, just while you mentioned them and their arguments for secession, that stood out to me. I have had, for years a Google alert out for the word secession, so I see everything that anybody is saying about it. And Glenn Beck is talking about it right now. And I saw that he was making the argument that the right should not secede from the United States, the left should secede from the United States, because they're the ones who are trying to change the Constitution or ignore it or overturn it, and we're the ones who are staying faithful to it. And that is pretty much, with the exception of they should secede rather than we, that's pretty much the argument that the Southerners were making. They were saying, we're going to leave the United States, but we're going to keep the Constitution as we understand it, as it was originally intended to be. You guys are the ones who have forsaken the purpose of the country's founding. And so there's some kind of quote that we're going to keep, have a new vessel, but pour the same old liquid into it and keep the substance of the Constitution as it was intended to be. I think there's a very similar kind of dynamic or thought process going on the right today, which is that even if, like today, right now, it looks like we are dabbling with patently unconstitutional and certainly undemocratic tendencies in American politics, you guys are really the ones who are violating the Constitution.
So here's a can of worms. We've done numerous shows over the years about the dangers of forces in the United States calling for an Article 5 constitutional convention to redo the Constitution. You are not entirely persuaded that this is a bad idea. Would you please state your case for our listeners?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that the hurdles are high enough to prevent anything horrible from passing into law, anything that, for better or for worse, those hurdles being high. I think that, there are enough obstacles that you need two-thirds of the states to agree to any changes are high enough to prevent anything really bad from going from being passed. And I think it is possible that we could pass things that really most people do agree on. I think overturning Citizens United, I think most citizens, most voters agree on. And that's not going to pass through Congress, you know, that kind of constitutional amendment, because those people are elected under the current system. So I think that we kind of need to take it into our own hands on that question. I also think we can reform the Supreme Court in a way that would get bipartisan support. I think that they should all have 18-year term limits that are staggered so that each presidential term sees the same number of vacancies. And there are ways to work it out so that if somebody dies in office, the role is filled in a nonpartisan way. I think that would take away the kind of roulette wheel situation that we have with Supreme Court nominations right now. I think because Republicans stole a seat from the Democrats, the court should be packed as well, and which would obviously be more controversial, and that can go through Congress. But I think that, we should institute Supreme Court term limits, and I think that would be fairly bipartisan. And I think there's a couple other things. The anti-Article 5 argument seems to me to suggest that we're simply not capable of self-government anymore. And I think that if we think that is the case, then we should say so and probably just pull the plug and break it up. I see a constitutional convention as kind of the last-ditch effort to save the country from total ruin. And if that fails, then, it's time to break it up.
My understanding of the argument against it is that it would be impossible to control what is done in an Article 5 convention, and that the powers that already have power, and forces like anti-democratic forces, would get control and it would run away. But that's a discussion we'll have to have for another day. Very briefly, Richard Kreitner, 10 seconds for final words for our listeners.
Please check out the book. I think it's a new version of American history that you probably haven't been exposed to. Do I have time to talk about the Constitutional Convention or no?
Very briefly.
Very briefly. I think it's interesting that what we describe as our fears of a second Constitutional Convention very much applies to the first, which is that it could be captured by shadowy, moneyed interests and that it would get out of control and they might propose things that we didn't sign up for, which is exactly what happened in Philadelphia and a document that most people celebrate and champion 250 years later or so. That there's a contradiction there, I think.
We thank you very much for your work and for joining us today on Forthright Radio, Richard Kreitner, and hopefully we'll have you back again because there's so much more to discuss.
I'd be happy to. Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Our guest today on Forthright Radio has been Richard Kreitner. We've been discussing his book, Break It Up, Secession, Division, and the Secret History of America's Imperfect Union, published by Little, Brown & Company. The views and opinions expressed on Forthright Radio are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of this station's staff, its members, board of directors, or contributors. Forthright Radio is a Beyond the Deep End production. I'm Joy LeClaire. You can hear past Forthright Radio programs by going to our website, forthright.media. Within an hour of this interview on January 6th, 2021, a mob left a rally in the front of the White House in which Donald Trump, Rudy Giuliani, and Donald Trump Jr. had exhorted them to march down Pennsylvania Avenue to the Capitol building and fight.
If you don't fight in the face of glaring irregularities, statistical impossibilities.
Fight for Trump! Fight for Trump! Fight for Trump!
Fight for Trump! They terrorized the U.S. Congress as it was in the process of fulfilling its constitutional duty to count the electoral votes in the 2020 presidential election, which had been certified and sent by the electors of the 50 states after much scrutiny by state and federal courts, sometimes recounting those votes several times. Senators, representatives, their staff, and members of the press were forced to flee in fear of their lives as the doors of their chambers were being rammed, and the sounds of howling insurgents mixed with the crash of breaking glass. One of the Capitol Police, Officer Brian D. Sicknick, who was wounded defending the sanctuary of our democracy, sustained a fatal blow to his head. He died the next day. Four of the rioters have died, one of whom was fatally shot as she was attempting to breach the door to the Speaker's lobby. For the first time in our history, we are not having a peaceful transfer of power from one administration to the next. As we reported in this show, just 3 weeks to the day after the last Confederate widow died on December 16, 2020, the Confederate battle flag was paraded through our Capitol building by insurrectionists. Not even during a brutal, bloody civil war did that happen. This, on top of reports of more than 4,000 deaths due to COVID-19 each day in the United States, with a death count of just under 370,000 as of January 9th, and a more contagious strain is proliferating. This has been made all the more difficult because two of the three members of Montana's congressional delegation participated in the perpetuation of baseless allegations that the 2020 election was fraudulent, despite the failure of more than 60 lawsuits being adjudicated throughout the individual states and federal courts, and a U.S. Department of Justice task force finding no such fraud, and Attorney General Barr's statement to that fact. The mere spinning and repetition of allegations, no matter how implausible, and the alarming credulity of a disconcerting number of our fellow citizens was apparently enough for former Attorney General Tim Fox to have joined a suit filed by the Texas Attorney General to invalidate another state's election, which was thrown out for even lacking the standing to sue. Then, Senator Steve Daines joined 11 other senators who organized to challenge the electoral votes of states other than their own when the congressional count was to occur on January 6. Newly sworn in Representative Matt Rosendale joined 146 other Republican members to object. After the insurrection and invasion of the Capitol, Senator Daines reversed his earlier stance and declined to object to the count. However, Representative Rosendale, as one of his very first official acts, did vote his objection to certify the results of other states. It is concerning that it has come to this, where the mere creation and repetition of allegations in the social media echo chamber, entirely lacking in credible evidence, can be cited by this many congresspeople to thwart our time-honored processes of democracy. It is analogous to someone who is accused of rape, taken to court, judged innocent, only to have new accusations and allegations hounding him, and then taken to court again to be found innocent over and over again. But his community hears the allegations endlessly repeated by important, powerful people whom they have a right and expectation to trust, who think, where there is this much smoke, there must be some fire. But in this case, the alleger in chief said even before the 2016 election that he will only accept the results if he wins. And for many months before this election, pettifogged about the validity of absentee ballots, which he himself uses, while the newly appointed postmaster general caused postal disruptions and delays. As for Senator Daines and Congressman Rosendale, history will remember their choices, which are now a matter of the public record. Regardless of their protestations after the fact, their willful promulgation of clear falsehoods regarding the elections cannot be rescinded. When someone, in coordination with others, puts more and more kindling onto a pile, it doesn't matter if he's not the one who finally strikes the match. Responsibility for damage from the resulting conflagration is his. The debacle in D.C. on January 6th was but the latest in an increasingly brazen expression of fascism in the United States. Democracy is difficult and precious, fragile and possibly failing. Those who study history know that it can happen here. Hannah Arendt said, quote, "The ideal subject of totalitarian rule is not the convinced Nazi or the dedicated communist, but people for whom the distinction between fact and fiction, true and false, no longer exists." End quote. In the wee hours of the night after the Senate had resumed their deliberation, many moving things were said. I quote Senator Mitt Romney, who has intimate knowledge of what it means to lose a presidential election. Quote, "Now we gather for a selfish man's senseless pride. The best way we can show respect for the voters who are upset is by telling them the truth. That is the burden. That is the duty of leadership. The truth is, President-elect Biden won the election." End quote. On the other hand, even in the midst of a dreadful pandemic, citizens went to extraordinary lengths and at times risking their own health to participate in the greatest voter turnout in our history. Donald Trump is correct to point out that no incumbent had ever received more votes than he did, 74.2 million. However, Joseph Biden received 7 million more than that, with 81.2 million votes. And as the U.S. Capitol was being invaded, Brad Raffensperger, the Republican Secretary of State of Georgia, and his senior staff had to be escorted from their offices for their safety after announcing the results of their special election, which unseated the two incumbents due to the militia members who had gathered outside the state capitol. So we end today's Forthright Radio honoring American voters who are the real heroes of this story of our democracy. Till next time, this is Joy LaClaire signing out for now.